Okay, thank you. For those who came late, again, my name is Shlomo Weissman. I serve as the director of the Beth Din of America. And what I'd like to do this morning, in the next half hour or so, is to walk you through an actual case that was heard at the Beth Din of America. For obvious reasons, I'm changing the whole story and the industry and a lot of the facts, and keeping the core halakhic and legal principles and even the amounts, roughly, that were at issue, just to give you a sense of kind of a typical case at the Beth Din of America. This was heard a few years ago, and it involved a family-owned electronics business, an electronics store that was family-owned. It was in the family for generations, called Schneider Electronics. And as the business started maturing, they wanted to branch out into new areas, maybe start offering and improving their online business. And there was a young person in the store who had kind of been there for a while. He was mostly in charge of the back room, the books, and he also had a little bit of a knack for online stuff. And so they got him more and more involved in the business. His name was Chaim Goldman. And at a certain point, they kind of came to a crossroads, and they decided to engage in a corporate restructuring and just change the whole ownership structure of the business in a way that would actually give this young guy, Chaim Goldman, an 18% interest of the newly restructured LLC. For that, he contributed $40,000 into the business, but that was really an understatement of what the business was actually worth. There was an expectation that sweat equity would play a role as well. He was very heavily involved in the day-to-day running of the business, as we said. And so he got an 18% interest in the new LLC, Schneider Electronics LLC. And for 1 or 2 years, the arrangement kind of worked. Although there was some infighting, they weren't 100% pleased with his performance. They thought he was more of a up-and-coming star than he actually was. And the relationship started to fray. And at some point, the ultimate betrayal occurred. The ultimate turning point in the story occurred when the Schneider family discovered that Goldman had started talking to a competitor on the side about some new online operation. The Schneider family viewed this as a complete act of betrayal, and they could no longer have anything to do with him. They told him he's out of the business, he shouldn't come back to the store. They were done with him. And they obviously had to deal with the issue that he was an 18% owner of the business. Now, the interesting part of this is this was kind of a Hamish operation, and they had never actually adopted an LLC agreement. Some of the cases we handle deal with these kind of messy situations where the lawyer kind of hired a cheap lawyer. He did half a job. He formed the LLC. He filed the certificate of formation, but no LLC agreement was actually adopted. And so at this point, the Schneider family adopted an LLC agreement without consulting with their 18% partner. And what they did was they enacted as a part of this LLC agreement, it was pretty much a plain vanilla LLC agreement, except for this section 3.10, which talked about removal of a member, where they said that any member can be removed by affirmative vote of 75% of the membership interests upon good faith allegations of gross negligence, malfeasance, or willful misconduct by a member. And interestingly, if that were to happen, he wouldn't get bought out at the then current equity value of the enterprise, but rather, it says, in full consideration of his membership interest, he would get an amount equal to his initial capital contribution. And so they figured they would, by 75% vote vote for this new LLC agreement, and they'd send him packing with the $40,000 that he invested. That's what they figured they would do. When Goldman found out about this, he was not pleased, to say the least, and he thought that the value of the business had actually increased over the last few years that he was working with them. In his view, that was largely due to his hard work, and they were just a bunch of slackers. And here they were trying to send him going with just a $40,000 payment that was completely inequitable, aside from the fact that he thought that his alleged act of betrayal wasn't really even gross negligence, malfeasance, or willful misconduct. He thought it was an innocent side business that he was running, and there was nothing wrong with what he was doing. Now, Section 417B of the New York LLC law has the following provision. It says that the operating agreement of an LLC can be amended from time to time without the written consent of each member adversely. I'm sorry, it cannot be amended. It says here, except as otherwise provided in the operating agreement, the articles of reserves were provided, however, that without the written consent of each member adversely affected thereby, no amendment shall be made that alters the manner of computing the distributions of any member. So you can't tinker with the financial rights of a minority member without input from that minority member. And so Goldman argued that this provision of the LLC law precludes them from adopting the LLC agreement that they sought to adopt. And creatively, Schneider's lawyer responded, that Section 417B only applies to amendments, but it doesn't apply to initial operating agreements. There was nothing in the LLC agreement that talks at all about minority rights in an initial operating agreement, and so there was nothing doing. They were absolutely free to adopt their discriminatory LLC agreement and send him packing with $40,000. And there was some discussion, some attempts at settlement, but as you can imagine, what eventually happened was Goldman was fed up. He contacted the Bethlehem of America. We sent a hazmana to the other side, to Schneider, and Schneider responded by agreeing to submit the matter to the Bethlehem of America. The parties signed a binding arbitration agreement, and we proceeded to have hearings on this issue. And after 2 hearings, the Dayanim heard all the evidence and all the arguments from both sides. We didn't get into a discussion yet of the actual underlying value of the business because we first dealt with the issue, this legal issue of whether they had the right to close out his interest for $40,000 or whether, on the other hand, he was right and that he was entitled to the full equity interest. And ultimately what the Dayanim decided was that the clear, and this is from the actual decision, it says the clear purpose of Section 417B, which was the one that precluded the discriminatory amendments, is to protect minority members from majorities seeking to harm them financially. As a matter of fundamental fairness, the principles apply with as much force to an initial operating agreement as it does to an amendment. And the Dayanim went on in their decision to speculate that perhaps the reason this statute only applies to amendments and not to initial agreements is because initial agreements are negotiated at arm's length. Everyone has the right to walk or sign the agreement at the initial stage. This was an unusual situation where they had, you know, shook their hands on the deal, were operating as a going concern for a few years, and then only later realized there's no operating agreement governing their entity. And so, in theory, the same principles should apply, and Goldman was protected. Schneider couldn't just throw him out of the business for $40,000. That was the psak. This was a little more nuance in the psak, and this draws on some of the principles that Rabbi Willard was discussing, the interplay of secular law and halacha. The Dayanim wrote, as a general rule, Jewish law holds that distributions from an economic interest in a business entity should be determined based on the arrangements agreed upon by the parties. They specifically cite to Choshen Mishpat, which talks about this idea of kol tanai shav mamon kayim. Parties are free to enter into contracts, into arrangements, even if those arrangements might differ from what halacha provides. And then it goes further and says that where parties organize their business affairs, right, this is a situation where there was no explicit, arguably no explicit governing law provision. It's not as if they explicitly said New York law should apply, because the whole thing that was in question was the validity of this operating agreement altogether. And so the Dayanim went further and said that where parties organize their business affairs by utilizing an entity that's a construct of secular law, such as an LLC, then the statutes governing that type of entity are what define the rights and obligations of the parties, consistent with the expectations of the parties. This goes a step further and says that even without an explicit agreement between the parties to adopt secular law, where there's an implicit agreement by the parties, or where they decide to do their business through an LLC, everyone's expectation is that the rules governing LLCs is what's going to govern their relationship And it cites to a very handy compendium, a multi-volume Sefer Pisachei Choshen that we very often use in the Beis Din. It's basically a treatise on Jewish law that has extensive footnotes. That's very helpful. And here, Rav Blau in Pisachei Choshen writes specifically that with respect to entities and associations whose primary power is derived from secular law, it's apparent that they are judged based on the regulations and statutes of the local law. And then the Danim just threw in for added measure that the truth is this wasn't even such a complicated case, and you probably would have arrived at the same result as a matter of Jewish law. They wrote that we arrive at the same result from Jewish laws. The economics of a partnership are based on an agreement of the parties, and even if it wasn't memorialized in writing at the time, everyone's expectation was that the plaintiff here bought a bona fide 18% interest in the entity. And you can't just throw the guy out and rob him of his property without any kind of due process and without any basis for doing so just because you think that he engaged in malfeasance. That was the psak that was issued. It was issued as an interim psak. Under our rules and procedures, we're able to issue interim psakim. Because the parties, this was a discussion that took place as part of the hearings, the parties thought it would be helpful for us to kind of do this in two stages, where we rule on the halachic legal issue, and then we could talk about valuation and talk about what that valuation should be. And then what happened next was that the parties and the dayanim got into a discussion in the context of the Din Torah about the best way to move on to stage two. And the dayanim suggested that perhaps this was a ripe issue for mediation rather than for us to issue a psak. If we had to issue a psak, there would have been had to be extensive discovery. They would have had to turn over their books and records. We might have even had to hire a business valuation consultant. That would have cost money. They would have had to continue to pay their attorneys for their litigation fees. And perhaps if everyone sat around the table, we could come to some sort of reasonable number. And this case was particularly ripe for mediation because this guy, Goldman, he was an insider in the business. So he kind of had a sense of what kind of volume the business was doing, what their profits, what their revenues were. He was even the back office guy who at one point had run their QuickBooks, had run their books and records. And so it made sense for them all to sit around the table and try to figure out if we can negotiate the valuation. So for schedule reasons, we didn't have all three dayanim participate in this mediation. We had two of the three dayanim participate in this mediation. It was actually myself, together with Rabbi Danny Rapp, who sits frequently as a dayan. And we met in the lawyer's office one day, and we did a kind of shuttle diplomacy between the two sides. One side was in one conference room, the other was in another conference room, and Rabbi Rapp and I went back and forth, and I'll walk you through a little bit of what that negotiation looked like and what the result was. And again, we're trying to figure out what's the value of the 18% of Goldman's interest in the LLC. Now, Goldman was operating a little bit in the dark because he didn't have the books and records. Also, some time had passed between his dismissal and now. He thought that the business had grown, as you'd expect, he thought the business had grown tremendously, and he was going to get a huge windfall now. They had a very different view, or at least they told us that their view was that business wasn't doing very well at all. In fact, it had run into some hard times. Too bad for Goldman. And so Goldman figured that this business was worth about $2.7 million. His 18% interest was worth about $500,000. That's what he expected to get. And he was pretty steadfast. He said, I'm already undervaluing this business because they're really doing well. They've struck it rich since I left. It's probably worth more like $5 million. But in order to be reasonable, I'll stick with $500,000 as my payout. The defendant, of course, had a completely different view. They said the business is worth more like $500,000. Your 18% is worth about $90,000. And we're not going a penny above that. Because, you know, $500,000 itself is a stretch. We're hitting hard times. Now, this, you have to realize what I'm going to go through now, I'm going to go through in about 4 minutes. But this played out over 5.5 hours of shuttle diplomacy between the two rooms. After working on it a little bit, we were able to convince Goldman that just in order to save on his attorney fees and call it a day, He should go down. And so he countered with 390. He was generous. He countered with 390. The defendant gave us a really hard time here. And they said, this is ridiculous. This business is not worth a penny more than $500,000. He's not getting more than $90,000. Aside from the fact that they went on and on about his betrayal and about how what a bad actor he was, he should really get nothing. He was the guy who ran the business into the ground. And so we tried to pull and pull and pull. And we pulled out of our hat what mediators call bracketing, where if you can't get a guy to throw a number out on the table because he doesn't want to budge from his position, you could kind of say to him, look, if we could at the end of today come with up a final number, maybe that's, you don't want to telegraph that number to the other side now, but maybe you could kind of make a conditional offer. And so they did that. They made a bracketed offer. They say, we'll go up to 105, but our offer of 105 is contingent on you coming down to 145. That was a way of subtly or not so subtly signaling that we're not going one penny north of maybe $125,000, somewhere in between this, if that. Right now we're only at 105, but we're not even at 105. We're only at 105 if you're at 145. Unfortunately, Goldman wasn't at 145. The best we could do after talking to him was to get him down to 225. And so we had this spread that was just, we couldn't do it. We couldn't figure out how to do it. And the clock was ticking. It was starting to get late in the day. About 2 weeks before this mediation took place, I had attended a three-day advanced commercial mediation training seminar at the city bar. And I learned there apparently a mediator's tactic called the mediator's proposal. The mediator's proposal is if you just can't get either side to budge off their proposal, off their last move, the mediator can kind of think about a number that bikoshi they might agree to, that just to completely settle it, that if there's not going to be any more negotiation off this number, maybe they'll come to this number. And so after trying and trying, we said to them, let's try this idea of a mediator's proposal. And Rabbi Rapp and I went to a third conference room and we sat there and tried to figure out what's the number that plaintiff will be willing to walk away from. He really didn't want to continue. He didn't have the pockets, the deep pockets to spend on continued attorney's fees. He really didn't want to litigate this, even though he felt strongly that the business was worth more. It would have cost him money. He was paying his lawyer. He would have had to pay a evaluator. And so he really, really was strapped. And the defendant also just wanted to end this. And so at the end of the day, anyone want to guess what the number was?
164.
190. 125. It was in between. 160 is the number that Rabbi Rapp and I proposed. And so we made secret ballots. We wrote 160 on one paper, 160 on one paper, a yes with a ballot, a checkbox, and a no with a checkbox, and the same thing on the other paper. And we handed it to both sides and went to the other room to wait for the ballots to come in. And these are the actual ballots. I saved them. So the first answer came back from Schneider, from the defendant. They checked the box on 160, and we waited and waited and waited for Goldman. He was on the phone with his wife, trying to figure out what to do. And finally, he came back with a yes, and we successfully negotiated a settlement to the case. That's basically, in a nutshell, the story of the case of Schneider v. Goldman. I think it's a good instructive example of the kind of work that the Bezdin of America does, because this kind of combines some elements of a few of our services. Here we have a situation where the Dayanim issued a decisive decision on a halachic legal principle that then opened the door to a negotiation with the help of the Dayanim on the valuation issue. It's not so unusual for a din Torah to end with a settlement. I would say probably 1 in 4 cases ends with the parties settling. Sometimes the parties go off to the other room on their own and settle. Sometimes the parties seek the help of the Dayanim to help negotiate an agreement. Whenever that happens, the Dayanim make it very clear to the parties that we can't forget information that you tell us. So especially if we're going to now break up into an ex parte situation where we're doing shuttle diplomacy, but even if we're going to negotiate all in the same room, if you share with us a little bit about your bargaining positions and then the negotiation fails and we ultimately have to issue a decision, so then obviously we'll try our best to kind of forget your flexibility and decide the case on the merits, but at the same time we're human and that's just the risk that you have to take. It's often worth the risk. We actually settled the case 2 weeks ago. That was a case that kind of went on and on and on. We probably had five or six sessions because it ran into a few million dollars, the amount that was in dispute. That was a situation where it was a similar situation with a breakup of a business, and there was so much emotion attached to that case that each side kind of had to go through the process of telling their story to the dayanim. There was a lot of yelling and screaming back and forth. But through that process, finally, after five sessions, we were able to convince them to stick around. Actually, they each had teams of attorneys. We sent home some of the more aggressive elements of their attorney teams, and we kept them back with just one attorney sitting quietly in the back to monitor the mediation, and we spent the next 3.5 hours, and finally, it was at the end of a session. The session had ended at 8 p.m. We then spent till 11 o'clock, I think, at night, kind of negotiating, and we were able to get to a negotiation. So that's just another, that's the kind of thing that happens somewhat frequently at the Beis Din. And at the same time, I'd like to clear up a misconception that I think a lot of people have about Dinei Torah and about the way that Batei Din operate, or specifically, I could say, in terms of the way the Beis Din of America operates. Some people think that when they come to rabbinic arbitration, when they come to a Beis Din, it's going to be a bunch of rabbis sitting behind a table who are all about shalom, and it's just best if everyone just goes home and ends in peace, and maybe we just split the baby, split everything in half, and everyone will go home. And the truth is, the rabbis are all about shalom. We try as much as we can to harbor and to facilitate goodwill and peace and harmony among the parties. But at the same time, we do so with an eye towards judging cases on the merits. When we need to judge the case, and more than often than not, we do judge the case. We do so with a reasoned opinion like we did in the first stage of this case, and we call it as it is. We will award all the money to one side or none of the money to one side. Sometimes it's a split decision just because the merits of the case warrant that. And that's really the principles by which we operate. Is my time up?
No, I need 7 more minutes.
7 more minutes. Okay, good. So let me talk a little bit about some other procedural issues. I think we're going to take questions at the end during the Q&A session.
Take questions now.
So I have to say the code word. For the people who are watching this on the live stream, first of all, welcome. We're happy that you're joining us. And in order to get your CLE credit, you're going to need to enter a code word on the online form that we emailed to you. And the code word is, what's the code word? French toast, which is not being served here. The code word is French toast. So if you're watching this online, just go onto the online form. You could do it now, or you could do it at the end of the program after all three code words have been announced. But the code word for this segment is French toast. People here don't need to enter code word because you'll sign when you leave. Let me talk for a minute about the... Let me talk for a minute about some of the other rules and procedures that govern cases at the Beis Din of America. One is the process of cross-examination of witnesses in the course of a Din Torah. Section 7506C of the CPLR in New York, and my guess is there's a similar provision in the New Jersey Code, talks specifically about gathering evidence in the course of an arbitration proceeding. And it says that the parties are entitled to be heard, to present evidence, and to cross-examine witnesses. Now, the truth is, generally speaking, in Beis Din practice, there is not such an animal as direct cross-examination of witnesses. The dayanim And this is one of the things that distinguishes Besdin practice from court process. The Dayanim are more actively engaged as kind of the law finders. The job of the parties is to present the facts, to present the story. Very often, lawyers can be very helpful in organizing a story, in organizing the facts, and doing so in a way that that makes it easier for the Dayanim to parse through the issues. But it's really up to the Dayanim to figure out what the halacha is and what the relevant law is that decides the case. And so when, for example, when attorneys come to the Beis Din and they say, well, I'm not an expert in halacha, I don't have that background, how can I really advocate for my client in a din Torah? What we tell them is precisely that, that the job of the lawyers is really to organize the facts and to present the facts in a coherent and organized way. And it's up to the Dayanim to figure out what the law is. And consistent with that, it's really up to the Dayanim to kind of push back against testimony, to interrupt stories, and ask follow-up questions, and more actively engage with the witnesses. Now, because the CPLR and secular law requires cross-examination, and also because we want to open the process up to an arrangement where there can be a back and forth so each side has the opportunity to make their case, very often what we'll do is we'll just tell the lawyers or the parties for a particular side that if you have questions for a witness on the other side or for a party on the other side, funnel your questions through the panel. So you could kind of suggest questions for the panel to bounce back to the witness or to the litigant, and we'll do that. That's practically speaking how we do it. In some situations where the cases are staffed by lawyer, where each side has lawyers, where it's heavily lawyered up, and the lawyers are just more used to a cross-examination, direct cross-examination, we'll dispense with that formality and we'll allow them to just directly cross-examine. But we'll monitor it and make sure that the temperature doesn't get too high in the room and that everything kind of stays kind and friendly. Let me talk about some of the other aspects of the rules and procedures that govern proceedings. One is, and I mentioned this in yesterday's program as well, but I think it's important to reiterate, is that there's an appeal process at the Beit Din of America that is unique to the Beit Din of America and that doesn't exist at other Batei Din. In our rules and procedures, you should all have a copy of that. Section 31 of the rules and procedures provides that within 20 days after we issue a decision, a litigant can come back and request modification of the decision, either because there's something technically deficient with the decision, we missed some key issues, we miscalculated a number, some more technical deficiency, or more broadly speaking, because we made a mistake of Jewish law. They can allege that we made a mistake of Jewish law. A mistake of Jewish law doesn't necessarily only mean a halachic mistake in Shulchan Aruch, but it can mean that we just botched the secular law as well. Because the whole theory of why we're bringing in secular laws, as we'll discuss, was because Jewish law looks to secular law. And so if we got the decision fundamentally wrong, you can file a request for modification within 20 days. The other side then has the opportunity to review that and submit a response. The responses can go back and forth. And ultimately, the paperwork is submitted to, under the rules and procedures, to the Av Beis Din, who typically delegates it to another dayan, who will review the record. They'll review the decision, review the request for modification, the responses, and then sometimes rubber stamp the lower decision. Other times, send it back to remand it back to the panel to reconsider based on some of the issues that were raised. And other times, simply overrule or revisit some of the issues in the case. The track record is pretty good for the lower dayana, meaning usually the appeals dayan kind of looks at it and sees that we got it all right. But there have been instances over the years where their matters have been remanded for reconsideration or modified. The mere fact that we have written rules and procedures is something also that's unique about the Beis Din of America and that distinguishes it from other Batei Din. I think as a practical matter, it makes us more professional. We're an institution that's more open and more comfortable for lawyers who are used to have written guidelines, written rules and procedures, Our rules and procedures are similar to what you'd see in a secular arbitration forum like the AAA, obviously with some modifications. But they provide for things as simple as making sure that there's a recorded record, a recording of hearings that take place, ensures and is very clear in writing that there is no allowance for ex parte communications. It's very clear about the issues that Rabbi Willig spoke about and that we touched upon a little bit, choice of law issues, so that it specifically provides in section three, section three is devoted to choice of law. So section three of the rules and procedures specifically say that where the parties, and this is 3D, where the parties explicitly adopt a choice of law clause, either in the initial contract or in the arbitration agreement itself, the Beth Din will accept that clause as providing the rules of decision. So we will faithfully adhere to a choice of law provision, provided and or specifically to the fullest extent permitted by Jewish law. So assuming that it doesn't run afoul, assuming that New York law or New Jersey law in a particular case doesn't run afoul of Jewish law, we will follow New York or New Jersey law. The number one example, most common example where that is a problem is in Hilchos Ribbis, where even if parties agree to charge or to pay interest, that's a non-waivable iser. That's not a Choshen Mishpat issue. That's a Yoredeya issue. That's something that's prohibited as a matter of Jewish law. And so we will not, in the absence of a heter isko, in an absence of documentation and specific structure that would allow the collection of ribbis, we wouldn't issue a decision that would allow for ribbis. That's just one example. But I hope this was helpful in giving you a sense of the kind of case that we handle it, the style in which we handle it, and the professionalism that we apply and that we bring to the table in adjudicating cases. Thank you.